Good evening, or afternoon, or morning. This is lecture two of OTI, and we're going to take up the principle of that man's basic means of survival is reason. Let me just say at the outset, I got only a few email questions during the week, but some of them are really good, and if there's time, I have extensive notes to answer them with. Assuming there's time, I'll put them on the end. Now, we're concerned this evening to reach the principle that man's basic means of survival is reason by induction, starting from perceptual observations and making no use of other objectivist ideas in the process unless it's absolutely unavoidable, in which case we just put a parenthesis around those other ideas and a note to ourselves that they require a separate pedigree, a separate inductive genesis. Now, this principle that we're doing today is pretty close to the perceptual level. It's the kind of idea that Ayn Rand, for example, knew well before she wrote The Fountainhead, long before she knew the complexities of Atlas Shrugged or objectivist epistemology. But don't worry if you find it too simple, because we're going to continuously up the ante as the course continues, and I hope at some point it'll become difficult enough to be profitable to everybody. Now, we have to do the whole inductive process, as I said last time, in a stripped-down, bare-minimum fashion. And the first application of that is in the actual wording of the principle we're trying to reach. Many principles have words in them for the sake of precision which are not part of the original inductive principle, but are inserted at a higher level of knowledge in order to make distinctions within a context much beyond where we are now. And these higher level words, even though they're built into your familiarity with the principle, have to be crossed out of the formulation at the outset so that just the substantive content of the principle as initially grasped is what we're focused on. Now, practically, that means that for today, you can forget about the word basic. Reason is man's basic means of survival, or his basic means of survival is reason. The reason that that word basic is in, obviously, it implies that there are derivative means, too. And there are many reasons for the inclusion of this, but one obvious one is that every organ of a living being is part of its means of survival. Your heart, your lungs, etc. All of those are necessary to your survival. And they're derivative in the sense that they're dependent on the proper functioning of reason. Otherwise, you'll finally kill yourself and your heart will stop and so on. So, if we left out basic and simply said, reason is the means of survival, it might be taken to imply that, well, by itself, thinking is enough to survive. You don't need to have your heart beat and breathe and so on. But we're neglecting that complexity at this stage. We simply want to show today that reason is a crucial, important means of survival. Its relation to other faculties and organs is a separate, specialized issue. All right. Where do we start? How do we start? What are the first things we should look at, remembering that we must start with perceptual data? Well, to give you a bad example, a horrible example at the outset, but a typical rationalist example, let me think aloud to illustrate what you should not do at this stage. Well, I don't know. Action is certainly necessary to survival. That just came to me. I mean, I don't know where, but it's obvious that you have to act or you'll die. So what if I reduce the problem to showing that reason is man's means of acting, and then if reason is man's means of acting, and acting is crucial to survival, etc. And I can perceive man acting, crossing the street, having dinner, making love, going to school, playing gin rummy, putting his clothes on, etc., etc. So maybe what I should do to get my initial perceptual data is start by listing actions and trying to show that each of them presupposes reason. Now, this is wrong. This is a rationalistic way of trying to simulate an induction without engaging in it. Because the person has arbitrarily picked on action for the sole reason of using it as what we call in logic a middle term. He wants to connect reason to survival, so he tries to find a term that he can connect on one side to reason, on the other side to survival, and then make his syllogism. Reason requires action, is essential for action, action essential for survival, therefore reason essential for survival. He's being governed in the process of allegedly inducing by a deductive model, and then he's pretending to look out for examples of action. For that very reason, because it's arbitrary, he has no idea what actions to pick on. Because in one sense, every action, or at least every rational action, is required for survival. So there's no way to know how to delimit, to pick these actions to start with rather than any others. And in another sense, many human actions, because of free will, are anti-survival, which we know because they're irrational. But that connection presupposes we already know that reason is man's means of survival. So this is out as an approach. This is an example of trying to deduce the principle using other ideas of objectivism. In this case, your knowledge that reason is what guides action. Your first thought should not be to look for a deductive middle term. The same would apply to saying, oh, well, knowledge is essential for survival, therefore, and reason leads to knowledge, because then you're still back to the same question. It's the same parallel starting with reason. So even true and relevant middle terms, arbitrarily picked, are not the answer. So come back to the question, where do we start? Well, we start here by reduction, which I indicated last time. We have to take the key concepts in our principle and trace back until they confront us with reality. And the principle says the means, man's means of survival is reason, so let's start with means of survival. Now, what would you have to know to reach such a concept or idea as means of survival? That is not something that a child has right away. It's something you have to reach, and this is the typical reductive question. What do you have to know to get to this idea? And it's obvious, there's a lot of things you'd have to know, but the point that's crucial for us right here is you'd first have to grasp the earlier notion that there are various things required for survival. First, of course, you'd have to grasp that there is life versus death, and that you need certain things to survive. Once you had that notion, you could then at a later stage say, I wonder how I get these things, by what means, what is the means of gaining these things, and that you'd call your means of survival. So hierarchically, you first have to start with things required for survival, and that will then lead you to the question of the means of gaining them. So we redound to the question, can we find things required for survival by direct observation? Now remember, we're looking for things that are non-controversial, that are obvious. And if it were the case that direct observation would give us a panorama of things required for survival, then we'd say, great, here are the things that we need for survival, and then that will lead us to the next question, by what means do we gain these? And our goal is to try to show that a certain mental faculty is our distinctive means of gaining these things. Now, so we've already indicated down in one from one term, means of survival, to we were looking for perceptual objects required to keep us alive. Now let's go to reason. And again, we have to reduce that. Now I start, as I commonly do, with the dictionary. I don't start with the faculty of measurement, omission, or anything like that. And the dictionary defines reason. Now, you know, you don't have to take all this down. It's better to try to absorb it and then write like a maniac and not follow any of it. A lot of people do that, with the idea they'll understand it later when they get home. But I suggest that you try to understand and just take a few notes and make the notes after the class rather than postpone the understanding while you're taking notes. So you don't need this dictionary definition, but the dictionary that I use defines it at reason as the mental power concerned with forming conclusions, judgments, and inferences. Or, other words, the power of thought, the faculty which engages in thought. Conclusions, judgments, inferences is what the dictionary says. Now, the question becomes, how would we get to conclusions, judgments, inferences? Can we find in what kind of way, what sort of thing you could, let me just say, theoretically do this whole assignment by sticking strictly with conclusions, judgments, and inferences and have no more knowledge of reason than simply whatever it is, it's the faculty of coming to conclusions from premises, making value judgments, drawing inferences. But I'm going to try to see if there's any way we could take this down one step to something simpler, or if not simpler, something that would make possible conclusions, judgments, and inferences. So take, for instance, the simple Socrates syllogism. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. That's the classic example of coming to a conclusion through inference. Now, what kind of things is it that we do that enables us, taking this as an example of reason, what kind of things that we do enables us to perform a syllogism? Obviously, we use language. And if we didn't know anything about language, we wouldn't be able to talk about conclusions, judgments, inferences, etc. These things are all expressed in words. So we have to have some knowledge of the existence of language. On this very example, we had to generalize in order to come to conclusions from premises. Now, whether you have to know what a generalization is, that's another question, but they're obviously closely connected. If you have no idea of a generalization, you're going to have a hard time forming such a concept as an argument which leads to a conclusion, because no arguments lead to a conclusion if they're not somewhere in there a generalization. And how will you come to the idea of a generalization? We're just reducing, you see, we're just going back. How will you come to the idea of a generalization in some form? You have to be able to grasp the idea of selective attention. Or you don't have to know the word abstraction, but you have to know, be able to grasp that man can do the following. He sees Tom, Dick, and Harry, and they differ in all these ways, but they all die. So he can ignore the differences and come to the general conclusion, all men are mortal. Generalization implies a certain capacity for abstraction. So to entirely grasp or to get a real grasp of a generalization, you'd have to have the, at least implicitly, the ability to grasp some kind of selective awareness, which children do. You could easily point out, they don't maybe not know the word abstract, but they very early, way before they know conclusion and inference, can recognize, if you have two chairs as against a table, ignore the difference in color. Oh yeah, they know that process of setting aside something for something else. You have to be able to grasp that man can do that. And there are many other things. You don't need a great deal to do this induction. But for instance, you might say, on that very Socrates example, the reason it's important is I want to buy a gravestone, or I only want to undertake a doctoral dissertation that'll take 20 years. In other words, you're planning long range, way beyond the immediate moment, and that's one of the things that makes you want to engage in these inferences and conclusions. Now, all of these things, language, the generalization, the ability to project the future, science we could throw in, are known to kids, young kids, in some form. And that's what gives content in their mind to the faculty which draws conclusions and forms value judgments by means of inferences. And that, in turn, is what then becomes reason. So, you see, I have not talked about forming concepts, or that it's done contextually, or that you do it by omitting measurements. Nothing. I haven't said what is language. What really is the process of abstraction? What do we mean by similarity? All these profound questions we don't have to have a clue about. But we're left then at this point. We have some content to a mental faculty we're calling reason. A lot of different things that we may or may not interrelate. Language, science, generalization, abstraction, long-range planning. Somehow all of it enabling us to think or infer conclusions from premises. And now our question is, that's as far as we have to reduce reason. No more than that. Now our conclusion is, our question is, we have discovered that we have to find things required for survival. So obviously then, we have to tie that into this mental faculty. Now this mental faculty does not, in and of itself, produce things required for survival. That's obvious to us at this stage. So what do we have to do then? Obviously we have to observe the physical goods, figure out what is involved in getting them, whatever it is, and then why a certain mentality, a certain kind of mental process is required to perform that process of getting them. So we have three stages of the induction indicated to us right at the outset. Certain goods are required. Some kind of action is necessary to get them. Therefore, some kind of thought process is necessary to get them, and that's it. Now, we have to validate each of those, but we're going to basically have three stages to our induction. Now, if you get from that the idea, you have a forecast now of the induction. Stage one, a bunch of things we're going to observe. Stage two, some process by which we get these things, again, has to be entirely observational. Stage three, the mental process that's involved in this other process, which again has to be observational, and that will mean reason gets us the things we require to survive, therefore reason is our means to survive. Now all of this is just simply from starting with the terms and going back to what we would have to do. And now all we have to do is do the induction, having forecast the structure of it by reduction. Now we're starting with the list of observable objects required for survival. Now, if you are not a rationalist, three things should come to you instantly, and that is food, clothing, and shelter. If you say self-esteem and freedom, that is hopeless. Hopeless. They never even enter the argument tonight because self-esteem and freedom require reason, require knowing that reason is your means of survival in order then to say why you need self-esteem and why you need freedom. So at this point of the game, that would be fantastic. You start with food, clothing, and shelter. Now, obviously, you can't see food as such, so let's clarify that point. You only see an apple, a steak, a glass of milk, etc. But we're allowing you to say food on the assumption that this is not a floating abstraction. If you want, you can summon up right now or at home a whole variety of foods and clothings and shelters, fabrics, and all the rest of it. And you should be able to evoke a flood without effort. Otherwise, go to Nordstrom's or go to a market. Until those are really concrete, you should have an unlimited number of perceptual examples that spring to mind instantly of things in these categories that sustain human life and without which we would perish. If ever you have a tendency to think that food means food for the soul, your whole argument is finished. It's got to be tangible, perceivable, sensory material if we're starting with the perceptual level. And now you must also have a wide enough range in each category so that you have a full basis to generalize. It is unacceptable if the only items of food you ever concretize are apples and carrots. because that means you would end up basically validating vegetarianism, but omit the vast amount of material from the food category relevant to reason. You'll forget all about hunting and its role, and that will throw you off the track altogether. Now, food, clothing, and shelter is merely the obvious start. That is, you not only want a wide range within them, but you want a wide range outside of them. You want to see the scope of the principle you're trying to induce. And the broader the range, then the more you know you're isolating the role of that principle in all kinds of different contexts. Now, what you should do is take advantage here of the fact that you live in a modern industrial civilization. It is not necessary to induce as though you lived at the time of the cavemen or on a desert island. That is not what going to the perceptual level means. Because there, food, shelter, and your cave would, loincloth would pretty much exhaust the list. But we have an abundance of perceptual examples today of things which observably promote and support our lives. Now, they're connected directly or indirectly with food, clothing, and shelter, but they gigantically expand the range and number of concretes that come under our survival needs, ours as members of an industrial society. And these are absolutely legitimate to include in your survey to the extent that they are aids to survival. They expand it, they make it safer, they combat life-threatening conditions. Now, what things could you add? Now you're going to ask me, is there an order? And let me give you another general principle. There is no necessary order on the perceptual level. Order is a phenomenon that applies to the conceptual level. When you are simply looking around and observing, you go on whatever strikes you. That's the way animals do it, and that's the way we have to do it on the perceptual level. So you look around, utilizing your general non-philosophical knowledge. One of the first obvious things you see, if we had time, you know, we do this in the Socratic method, and I would pull it out of you and so on, but we don't have time to think in this course, just to take notes. The obvious role of tools. Now, they're not a primary in the sense of a consumer's good, like food or clothes, but without tools, there wouldn't be any food, clothing, and shelter. There'd be no, only extremely primitive. No way to pierce the soil so as to plant or thresh grain, no needle to sew the shirts, no hammer to get the boards into the house frames, etc. It's not true that man is a tool-making animal as a definition, but tools are certainly indispensable. Here again, the whole thing rests upon the fact that you have a very prosaic, literal mind. We do not mean tool of a foreign agent or anything remotely like that. We're talking about hammers and saws and pliers and wrenches is what we're talking about, and that's what you see when you open your eyes. Now, if you follow this far enough in an industrial civilization, you find the whole category of more complex tools that are required to make the tools necessary to create the primary goods.
Hello.
Yes. And here again, there is a virtually unlimited range of material that you can directly observe. Now, what else? I'm just jumping around to give you an idea. This is the type of thing you can multiply and expand as you wish at home. But what else is involved? Now, in a sense, you could say everything we use to help us is a tool, but we're using that now in the narrower sense of that I've indicated. But over beyond tools, what other obvious things are perceivable and essential to survival? Weapons is an obvious category, as required for hunting or for self-defense. And then, of course, there's a whole bunch of subdivisions under there. Medicine is an obvious category, all the different kinds of medicines and herbs, and etc. There is only your lack of ingenuity will prevent you from multiplying the objects because they are literally everywhere. This is what I mean by a flood. You cannot walk anywhere, open your eyes, and not perceive another trillion things required for our survival. You just walk outside, for instance, you have to move to get there. So you have to take the elevator or a bicycle, or you need an airplane or a ship or a car. You have the whole category of means of transportation, etc. Now, that's all I'm going to do on the first stage. An abundance of things that man incontestably needs, physical, perceivable concretes, open to our senses without bringing in any objectivism. There's nothing in here like you need self-esteem or the pleasure of achievement or anything remotely like that. That's the first stage. Now we're trying to show that man's basic means of survival is reason. The second stage we forecast is that something is involved to get all these things. Well, you might say, what about if we just say right here, do all these things come from reason? Short circuit, you know, go right now, jump to the climax. I would say, if you didn't know objectivism, that would be much too big a jump if you were learning this principle independently from reality, which is what you're supposed to be doing, guided by the adult advanced knowledge, but you're supposed to be recreating the actual steps that a mind would require. We don't have any idea where these things come from at this stage. We just know that they're important. So the next obvious question before anybody would jump to the role of the mind in getting them is, where do they come from? Before you know where they come from, you couldn't even begin to ask, and what role does reason play in this process, because reason is not their direct source. So hierarchically, the first question you'd have to ask once you know there are things is, where did those things come from? How? What did we do, or what had to be done? Now, how are we going to answer this question? Well, you know, of course, creativity, we all know that, but that's not the question. The question is, how are we going to answer this now as inducers? And that, the key here, is another absolutely crucial rule of inductive methodology. And this one you can write down if you're writing anything. The importance of contrast, C-O-N-T-R-A-S-T. In concept formation, we start, say, with two tables, but you can't form a concept out of 2 or 10 tables per se. It's only tables in contrast to chair, or tables in contrast to a bed. And that same principle is applicable in induction. You can't come to a generalization from a vast group of concretes except against some contrast, which makes your principle stand out. And as something has happened, I'm getting some feedback here. Okay. Some contrast which makes your principle stand out. So what we are looking for now is some kind of area or field. I'm deliberately being painstaking because later in the course you won't know what the answer is you're looking for, and you'll have to go through the process. I don't know why we're getting feedback. Is there anything you can do?
Help.
What? You know?
I think that might help.
Is it still recording?
I'll double check.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. I'm sorry. We're having some survival problems here. We want to contrast an area where all the things we're talking about as necessary for survival don't apply. Some case where there's survival without tools, bicycles, stockings, and pies, etc. And then we try to look at the two situations side by side and get a clue as to what causes the objects. What is present when they're present and absent when they're absent? And in our topic, the The contrast comes in this way. We have an abundance of physical life-sustaining goods. So we ask, is there a species that doesn't have this abundance of goods accessible to it? That's not surrounded with homes, clothing stores, markets, wheat fields, etc. Now, you could go to Iraq for the contrast if you wanted, or the Middle Ages, but it wouldn't be too clear because they do have some of these human goods in as much as they're human. And you can only sink so low as a human being. The obvious, clear-cut contrast is to the lower animals. They don't have these things, and we do. And yet they have to survive, and so do we. So it's obvious when we're talking about man's means of survival, vital to our induction, is going to be the difference between man and animals. And we're led to that from the very first stage, from the very first object. Now, this is where Harry Binswanger's method of the genus comes in. Because the genus basically tells you, what are you making your contrast to? The genus method, which we indicated last time, is a way of systematically organizing your contrasts. So you know exactly within what category you're coming to a conclusion as against what. Now, here again, if we use the Socratic method, I would elicit it from you, but we're talking about different species with a means of survival. So you could either cast your genus. Now remember, it has to be a proposition in induction. The genus is not a term, it's a whole statement. And it can either be every conscious species has a means of survival, or every living species has a means of survival. It makes no difference how broadly you cast it, as long as we get the essential contrast. And then once you write that down, you would subdivide it, say, into animals and plants, if we take the broader formulation. Plants, we know as adults now, gain the values they need by unconscious chemical means. Animals, by locomotion directed by consciousness. And now we want to make the important contrast within animals. So, you know, if you're going to make a chart with an arrow to, what do you call those two lines, Harry, coming down from the word?
Two lines coming down, right.
You subdivide animals into man and the lower animals. Now, as adults, we know right away the lower animals are distinguished from man because they're guided only by perception and man by thought. But we don't need to go into that knowledge at this point. The point is only this. Within this total framework, we are told now, basically, our point of reference is within the category of entities that remain alive through consciousness, there's an essential difference between animals and men. And obviously, we're going to try to find out what it is if we didn't already know that it's their form of consciousness. We haven't reached the adult conclusion or the inductive conclusion yet, but what we've done is set up a contrast that is going to show up repeatedly at every stage of the induction. In every one of the levels, that contrast is going to be there, and if you milk it, it'll help you. So, for instance, even on stage one, the kind of objects, once we've got the contrast, we look out and we say, you know, that's distinctive to us because animals don't have all those objects. And now we get to coming to the second question, how do we obtain them? Well, we look right away, what do animals do? Animals just sees what's there, but we can't seize what's there because it's not just there. So you can look, you can either figure it out, but rather than be rationalistic, let's just observe. So we're now observing from the point of view of, we have to do something as against animals. What do we do to get these values? And again, you can plunge in anywhere. Remembering always it's in contrast to animals. Well, let's start with food. Animals just eat each other or eat what's wild on the trees, etc. What about human food? Well, we don't get very far by eating berries and so on. We have to grow it. Animals don't grow it. And what does that involve? Growing, we have to plant and sow and till and irrigate and reap and this and that and the other. The whole realm of agriculture and food preparation, all of which you can actually observe. And here you can, you know, go from your general knowledge of reading. You don't have to have percepts. But it would be nice to know that farms exist and, you know, what it looks like for something to wave in the wheat in the wind and so on. Clothing. The same thing. We have to gain the materials from animals. And that means we have to capture them, skin them, breed them, tan the material, cure, combine. So there's a thousand different activities before what's out there wild becomes clothing. And then, you know, I'm not even talking about designing and higher decoration and Ralph Lauren and etc. And homes, you can read the Fountainhead. For architecture. We have to engage in a whole variety of perceivable physical activities, utilizing the raw materials of nature, but turning them into the acres of food, clothing, tools, etc. we have. Now, we're not asking yet what enables us to take these activities, but we've gone one big step beyond saying we need X objects, because we're now saying the objects, as we observe the process, are all objects that men have to do something to get, something specific, a specific kind of action. Not merely the action of consuming and seizing, but the action of producing or creating. And that is something we would reach just by abstracting what is in common with tilling and irrigating, etc., etc., etc. There'd be thousands and thousands of instances. Again, just as big a flood as on level one. And the common abstraction is production, which is therefore a completely inductive conclusion. So it's not enough to say, well, man has to act to get it. Animals have to act too. Even plants have to act. The unique thing is specifically productive action. So that's the second stage. And you see, we've had two inductions now. And now we get to point three. We produce all these things and animals don't. What makes the difference? What accounts for the difference? What enables man to create tools, medicine, etc., whereas animals rely only on what they find in nature? Why can we grow wheat, weave cloth, etc., etc.? I'm cutting out obvious repetitions here. I'm obviously leading you here to the conclusion that reason is what makes production possible, and therefore, I mean, that's what we're aiming at, and therefore all of the necessities of survival. But how would we initially reach the idea that reason is at the root of production? It is unacceptable to say, well, that's man's unique faculty, and since he's the unique producer, that must be the faculty that causes production. That's pure rationalism. The only way to find out that reason is the root of production is to observe productive processes and see what they actually require. Is there something in common among all of these productive processes that indicates their source? Is there any mental process that we can observe that goes into all the productive acts we've already induced from? And here again, you jump in anywhere. And this is on the level that a high school student who does not know epistemology nevertheless could grasp and prove in his context that reason is man's means of survival. Now, what you look for now depends upon what is your idea of reason. If your idea of reason is the things we mentioned, the ability to selectively focus or to generalize or to use language or whatever, or if it's three or four or five of those loosely connected in your mind, you don't know what it is, you just plunge in, start with agriculture for the hell of it, and see whether you can find anything that comes under reason in the process of agriculture. Well, somebody had to grasp the connection between the seed and the sprouting plant. They had to grasp a causal relationship, and that's obvious from the most elementary productive activity, how to start a fire, cook food, cure disease, etc. We have to see the connection between events that to an animal are simply percepts, discrete percepts. And that involves an implicit, right away, generalization, right? Every time we make a causal connection, we're saying whenever there's X, there is Y. Without these generalizations, we could never get started on the process of production at all. Well, what makes it possible to generalize? Every seed is unique. Every field is unique. Every stone in the field is unique. But what we can do is selectively attend, strip away the differences and say, well, even though this is bigger seed and smaller seed and darker seed and lighter seed and so on and so on and so on, they all have this in common, which the animal can't do. And the same for grass and whatever it happens to be. We can see the similarities from one to the next and ignore the differences. In other words, abstract, whether we know the term or not. Over and over in agriculture, you can and have to come up with examples where the whole thing depends on the ability to selectively attend, to abstract, and therefore implicitly generalize. How do we know that irrigation is necessary? Whether it's, you know, the thing is in the north or the south or near Farmer Brown or the crop is brown or the crop is green or whatever. And all the different waters coming from different sources with different smells and all the rest of it. But we can abstract away from all that to the idea of moisture or water and crop and put the two together and get a generalization. And the same for discovering the role of fertilizer, climate, etc. The route throughout agriculture, wherever you look at every single stage that distinguishes us from the animals, is we can see similarities in the midst of differences and abstract them out. Now, that's just one way. But suppose you had a different idea. You didn't attach that much grasp to similarity and abstraction in your view of reason. And you only grasped, well, the thing that reason permits us to do is plan a long-range future, whereas animals are just restricted to the minute. And you didn't have the level of knowledge to know how come, but that struck you as that's a crucial thing within reason. That's different from animals. Well, then you see right away, even on agriculture, that without that ability, there would be no agriculture. Because the whole idea is to put the seed in now, so you're going to get the crop after so many months. Or we're going to hunt right now because next week we won't have any food when the animals migrate that we're hunting, etc. Whatever we look at, once it's in the realm of production, we're already talking about a long-range projection, not just the immediate moment. Now, you may have no idea what that has to do with the faculty of abstraction, but you know this has something to do with human awareness. We can know a future that governs our actions now, even though we can't perceive it, and that without that, we couldn't be the productive element creatures we are. That alone is sufficient to come to the conclusion that whatever our mental faculty is, that's essential to our form of survival. Now, you could jump in with language, which any kid knows. In productive activity, writing, speaking, communicating, the use of language is everywhere. The foreman tells the workers what to do, and you have to tell the doctors your symptom, and you can't build a plane before you read a book on aeronautics, etc. Now, you may have no idea of language, except, well, we use a word to name a lot of similar things. But somehow, it's something you have that is involved in your mental capacity that animals don't have and that is essential to production. Now, throw in another one, science. And here's a case where we can look at history. What was the difference in terms of productive abilities when science entered the picture? Now, everyone today, even the most elementary mentalities, know that the West has far surpassed the Orient. We have direct empirical evidence, even if people don't know how it happened, that there's science, that that involves math, and that when there's an awful lot of this, there's machinery and an industry and wealth. And the dumbest person knows that somehow, the press commenting on the astronauts knew that somehow Isaac Newton was relevant to this, although they didn't have a clue as to how. But there was even a mention, gee whiz, Isaac Newton was involved in this procedure. Now, if you didn't know anything, you know animals don't have science. Science pertains to man's means of awareness, and science is obviously the root of a vast torrent of productive activities that would be impossible without it. That in and of itself is sufficient. Now, I'm just trying to show you, we may not know what science has got to do with abstraction or any of the rest of it. It's another example, without being an epistemologist. I'm not going to just keep on multiplying, but you should be able, at this point, you have enough aspects of reason that you know as projected teenagers only, and enough examples of production. You should be able to go for literally weeks without repeating yourself, giving examples, different examples, of the role of the human mental process in the production of wealth. All kinds of different aspects of rationality or reason, all kinds of different fields of production. It's literally endless. Wherever your eye looks, if I look at a microphone, a piece of paper, a scarf, a rug, coffee, everyone should generate 1,000 examples. That's what I mean by a flood. A flood does not mean, you know, what I used to think when I started philosophy, that by hard work you could dredge up 2 examples and then you go home because you've already given the rationalist proof anyway. A flood is like this, that it's just literally endless examples. That is what Ayn Rand had behind every single every single principle that she held, which is why when people disagreed with her, she was constantly aghast, you know, as she could intellectually understand, but the evidence was so abundant and overwhelming that it was constant shock to her that it wasn't obvious to people. So let's summarize our third stage. We have some kind of mental faculty. Whatever it is, we have some ideas of what its distinctive features are. And that is reason. And that is ample for you, this is all repetition of what I've written out here, that is ample for you to conclude that that faculty makes possible production and therefore the values necessary for survival. That's the third and the last induction. So the whole argument is we need certain values, certain physical objects, and that's inductive. And we perform countless processes of production of all kinds to get them. And that is inductive. And we rely on a variety of uniquely human mental processes to be able to carry out these actions. And therefore, the summation of all of that vast torrent of observations is the few words, man's means of survival is reason. But that is simply a condensation of all of these observations. And without these three vast sets of observations, that would not be a principle tied to real. Now, we're free, as we develop, to get a more sophisticated view of reason and tie in together some of these things and go into higher epistemology, but whatever we learn won't contradict what we already know. Now you've seen an example of an objectivist principle reached inductively. And this was reached by Ayn Rand very early in her life, very early. I don't know whether before she came to America, but certainly way before the founding. When she didn't have any idea what a concept was. Or that life was a standard. Now let's deal, one of the written questions raised this question, I'm going to answer it here. Was the questioner will remember he quoted Tootsie, which I'm not going to take the time to do, but whoever you are, you know your question. And this is the question, well, we know that reason is man's means of survival now, but does it have to be so? Does reason have to be man's means of survival? Can I prove that that's the only possibility and therefore that it has to be true in the future, not just up to now? Now, this is a rationalist, not that Tootsie is a rationalist, but this is the rationalist mentality. Now, let's concretize what that question is asking. The question is asking, is it possible for man someday to survive by means other than reason? Well, you couldn't ask that question and say, well, what means did you have in mind? What means? Now, on what basis would we even guess what it would be? It's not reason, it's something else. So, under these imaginary conditions, the first question we have to ask is, well, does he still have the faculty of reason or not? Now, if you say, no, he doesn't have reason anymore under this scenario, then we're not talking about the same species. That's got nothing to do with man. I'm not saying man will always exist. Maybe we'll all be annihilated. But the induction says that when he does, reason will be his means of survival. So if you say, well, there's going to come a day when man doesn't have reason anymore, that's a different species and the whole question has changed. So the projection has got to be that he has the faculty of reason. He is like man today, but he doesn't need it in order to produce. Well, what then is production and how does he do it under this scenario? Well, now this just depends on the guy's fantasy. I mean, you can go on like this forever, but suppose he says, well, he doesn't need production. The goods will be there. Well, where do they come from? Well, he says, I have no idea. You know, the goods are here. Or he says, well, we'll have a new faculty of production. Well, what is it? I have no idea. Now, every one of these claims that maybe it's not necessary, what we've just induced, is exactly comes down to, I arbitrarily hypothesize the following of which I have no idea. Now show me that it's not going to be so. And if you know what's wrong with hypothesizing the arbitrary and demanding a proof of a negative, then you won't never let that question in at all. Because as soon as you heard, how do you know this is going to hold? You have a mass, three masses of observations on one side and a completely arbitrary hoodlum on the other side saying, who knows, maybe it's all wrong or it's all going to vanish tomorrow. And if you actually define your concepts as you should on the basis of observation, you can't even literally conceive anymore his question. Because you define now, you import your inductive knowledge into your concept. Man is the rational being and reason is the faculty of production. And when you say to me, and production is the means of survival, all of those definitions are from observation. And now when you say to me, imagine man who doesn't need reason, it's not. There should be no content in my mind anymore because those concepts are empty now. He's blasting the total of my observation. Now, here is a case I'm submitting to you of an induction which cannot be deduced from something more fundamental and which is 100% convincing on purely inductive grounds. Every step is sustained by observations and nothing suggests any other possibility. It's the total of our knowledge condenses into this statement, and it's absolute effrontery to say on top of all of this, but why? You know, I would have done it differently. How? I don't know. Now I got another polemic against rationalism here, but I don't think you need it. I think by now, if it hasn't reached your mind that you need induction, and you think you could reach this by an a priori proof, I don't think another example will convince you. Now let's ask some clarifying further questions here. How much else about reason do we need to know to reach today's principle? Do we yet have a theory of man's means of knowledge? Do we have a theory that reason is man's means of knowledge? Now, we obviously have learned that there are some things we can learn from reason and only from reason. That much we've learned. But do we know how reason works? Only in a very sketchy, preliminary way. It has something to do with selective attention or with inference, or, you know, just like the man on the street. So let me ask this question. Do we know at this stage that reason is our only means of knowledge as against mysticism? No, we definitely do not. We haven't even raised that issue implicitly at this stage of the game. So far, our conclusion is compatible with the idea that we have two means of knowledge, a worldly one which guides our survival activities and a superworldly one which brings us into contact with higher truths. Now, there's no basis for that. I'm simply saying we haven't even raised the question how many means of knowledge we have. All we've established is that reason is essential to the kind of action which keeps us alive. That's it. And this is going to have a parallel in every induction. There's 1,000 things we could say about our means of survival that we didn't get to tonight. We need a lot more than food, clothing, and shelter and tools. And there's 1,000 things we could say about reason. But we're starting with just what you need to get started. Some idea of perceivable things you need to survive, and some idea of the type of processes that come under reason, and a step-by-step concept of the connection. All the other things we don't yet know and don't have to know. If you have to specify what you don't know and don't have to know. Otherwise, you're going to never be able to induce, because you're going to be constantly swamped by the feeling, oh my God, there's a million things I have to show about reason. What if somebody says, well, man couldn't survive by reason unless he was able to control his emotions, and therefore to really show that reason is man's means of survival, we have to show that he has control of his emotions. Now, in the totality, that's true. If Plato was right, and emotions were uncontrollable, we would be basically in the position that our survival was in continuous jeopardy. And we couldn't really survive. We'd be schizophrenic. But we're not trying to answer everything now. We're just trying to get in the door with the idea that thinking leads to the goods necessary for survival. All the higher ramifications and complexities that is necessary to have an unanswerable case on everything is obviously not what you have at the beginning. You only have the one little point at the beginning. And it itself takes 2 hours, and I didn't even do the examples. I just sketched them out for you. I mean, Ayn Rand would not arrive at this in 2 hours. It would be weeks of chewing examples and trying to see every possible nook and cranny of history and what happened to production in the ages when they had reason and what happened to production in the ages where they denied and disowned reason, etc. Every corner of the globe before she would get it, and how does it relate to her context and her life, the things she does, etc. So, okay, let's assume I've hammered that point enough. Now I want to point out to you 2 different senses of the hierarchical structure of knowledge. And let's call it the OPAR, using that acronym, versus, now I'm told you can't use an acronym for three letters, so I can't say OTI, I have to say OTI. So it's the OPAR versus the OTI sense. And I think you can understand this. In the method I used in OPAR, I had a hierarchy of knowledge in a definite form as follows. I assumed I had already reached and defined all the principles of objectivism before I started the book. And the question I was asking is only, how can I organize them in a logical order so that each chapter and sequence is a precondition of the next? Now, from that point of view, I had to cover epistemology before ethics, because until we know how we know, we can't validate any knowledge, including ethical knowledge. And until we establish the nature of a conceptual consciousness, we couldn't discuss the mode of survival of a conceptual being. So from the OPAR point of view, the theory of concepts necessarily goes in an early chapter, and the theory of man later. Now that's the hierarchy in OPAR, where you start with the axioms and you go into all the complexities of epistemology in a certain structured order, and then the nature of man, ethics, politics, etc. But that does not change the fact that there is a hierarchy in the opposite direction, which is the inductive hierarchy. A person with no preliminary idea of reason, no idea of reason from observation, could never conceive such a question as the nature of concepts. It never get to epistemology. And the only way first-handedly to get a notion of reason is by observing men use their minds. And how? By watching the various crucial things that they do, one of which is production. So, in this process, man's means of survival is in effect part of the data that leads us back to the crucial role of reason. We were in the middle of two types of hierarchy. And I was now trying to introduce to you the OTI type of hierarchy. There's two forms of mental movement. The inductive movement from observation, and then the hierarchical finished organization going from fundamentals to applications and implications. In the inductive process, you start with observations that may come from late in the OPAR book and get principles that ultimately lead you to the fundamentals, which then become the base of the OPAR book on which you organize all the rest. So, to grasp objectivism fully, you have to take the main points, the main principles, and do what we did today on each. In other words, you have to separately induce as much as you can. And then, when each separately is really clear, read OPAR to organize it all into one total. But you can only read OPAR with the understanding that every formula in the book is a summation of a vast number of concretes, only one or two of which are suggested as illustrations in the book. It would be impossible, you know, with each principle to have a two-hour lecture on the induction, because the mind couldn't hold it. Now, I want to point out in passing that we have a lot of material tonight on why Ayn Rand said she couldn't reach her philosophy before the Industrial Revolution. You see, from the whole process of induction, it hinged on the abundance and variety of material objects involved in our survival and the vast diversity of productive processes and how all of them involve abstract thought, science, and so on. That's the data that wasn't available to the Greeks. To them, survival was a matter of unthinking repetition of age-old practices, just churning out a few standard items. And science and abstract thought hadn't yet borne any fruit And to them, they can only say it's an end in itself. It's a satisfaction of curiosity. Therefore, now follow this. You could have shown them on their own concretes that even the slaves needed to perform acts of abstraction, language, long-range planning in order to perform their menial acts of subsistence. And the Greeks would not have said, aha, reason is man's means of survival, let's all be objectivist. Because they would have said what they did say. Well, of course, that's practical reason. And of course it's necessary. But that's not reason in its important and glorious sense, in the sense in which it gives us science and math and philosophy. And so the philosophic point was lost on the Greeks. If you gave them this whole lecture on the concretes, they knew it would become a kind of insignificant side issue observation. Yeah, that's important. But that's for the lower type of minds, rather than something that indicates man's metaphysical relation to reality, or the potential of the highest and noblest man. And that's what the Greeks had no way of knowing. And that's why Ayn Rand said that she could only have reached her philosophy after the Industrial Revolution. Now, I have another thought on Ayn Rand's mental processes that are helpful here. Project a situation, this is purely hypothetical, where a young Ayn Rand has gone through this induction and has come to the conclusion, that's all she knows, let's say, about philosophy, that reason is man's means of survival. The key to her uniqueness, I say, is that even if she knew only this one point, she would hold on to it as an absolute in all future cognition or argument. Now, for instance, suppose she never heard of Plato, and she had no metaphysical or epistemological views at all. And somebody at a cocktail party or in school said to her, reason doesn't relate to physical reality. It really pertains to another world of abstractions or universals. The senses are our only means of connecting to this reality. Her immediate answer would have been, that isn't true, because reason guides a productive process. It works on the things we observe and enables us to produce, and that's obviously this world. Whereas animals have the senses but can't cope with this world successfully. So whatever else is true of reason, it must be wrong that it's an otherworldly faculty. And she knows this. Notice, this is the secret of Ayn Rand. She knows this not from studying epistemology, but from observing production. The refutation to Plato she gets from observing agriculture. And nobody else in history could make that claim. Or if somebody tells her, oh, reason is impractical, but what about the emotional element of human nature? What about other people? How can you live with them by reason, etc.? Maybe she doesn't know the source of emotions or what causes other people or even how to deal with them. But she knows that since we survive by a reason, it obviously can't be impractical. Her starting point for whatever the question is, reason is practical because that's how we survive. You see that only one principle properly related to reality gives her right away a set of, quote, instincts about the most abstruse philosophical issues. It keeps her pointed in the right direction, and that is the whole secret to her consciousness. Even when she knew very little, she organized and filed the data in whatever order it came to her. She organized it. She reached it inductively. In other words, as summaries of observation, of reality. And therefore, she hung on to what she knew and ruthlessly threw out whatever contradicted it, in the same way you would if somebody said, this table is not there. She said, I don't know your argument, but I see the table. That's it. This basically inoculated her from being tempted by false philosophic theories, and the idea of the course is to give you the same impregnable protection against the philosophic poisons that surround you. And the protection is that whatever you know it by induction, not by deduction. That's what keeps you tied to reality. Now I'm going to give you the assignment for next time, and then I'm going to take up some written questions. And it may be possible to ask some people on the phone to volunteer a question if your own can figure out a way. Now, the biggest city that I can find is a place in Wisconsin, if I can find it here. Colgate, Wisconsin. So just for the hell of it, if you're in Colgate, if I get through the written questions, remember we have 6 minutes plus 4 minutes, which is grace time. So we have 10 minutes after the hour before this ends. So if I get through the written questions after I give you the homework, I'm going to go to Colgate, Wisconsin. And if you can come up with yourself and choose a leader and be prepared to speak if I get there. Now, first, the assignment for next time. The principle of egoism. Our first overtly ethical principle. That is not simply reason. Is man's means of survival? Cause and effect is a law, but man is the proper beneficiary of his own action. He should be selfish. He should be concerned with his own interests, etc. You formulate it however you find it easiest, remembering you want the most elementary context. Now, since this is ethical, we have to obviously assume free will. But I'll let you assume that. Don't even bother with that. We've established already that man is volitional as far as this is concerned. You tell me, what do you observe in reality that warrants the principle of egoism, which itself is a generalization, of course? All acts of self-sustenance are proper, and no acts of self-sacrifice are proper. I mean, you don't have to use that wording, but I'm just bringing out the generalization. What do you observe in reality that warrants this? And is it just one stage? You just look out and right away you say, aha, it's proper in this case, in this case, in this case. Therefore, I generalize. Or do you observe a bunch of instances and then you go through several stages and what accounts for that, what accounts for that? Until you finally come to the conclusion of egoism or what? Now, try to use the reductive method. Start with what you mean by egoism and what would I have to know to get there, etc., etc. Try to use the genus method. Egoism pertains to the beneficiary of your actions. What would the broader principle be? And what are you contrasting it with? And try to use whatever creativity God gave you innately and put it all together. And that will be our topic for next time. Now I want to go. See, I left out so much that struck me as repetitive that I have time for, actually for questions, which is terrific. But I'm giving priority to a few of these written questions, at least. And here happens to be on the top an interesting question. I guess I shouldn't give the name, or is it on the radio? You just give the first name. So that's what I'll do. I'll give the first name. Michael from Utah. So that doesn't identify, I guess, to an objectivist audience. Pretty much identifies you, but that's what I do on the radio. This is the substance of your question. Now, you apropos the point that you couldn't, Ayn Rand couldn't have reached reason as man's basic means of survival without the Industrial Revolution. He wants to know, what do you do if there exists little or no concrete instances of certain things? There's a lack of data. Would this prevent inductions from being made? Now, on the face of it, the answer is obvious, but he goes on to explain the obvious answer is yes. Without data, you can't generalize. But he says, what about the role of art in man's life? Does art as a projection of what is possible provide in a way the inductive data needed to project how life ought to be? If there is a lack, say, of virtuous men or of a just society, a complete lack of data to perceive, does art provide man with a projection of data with which to work, sort of a substitute data set? That's a fascinating question, to which I come down with a ringing yes and no. In one sense, definitely, art works just the way you do. If I take someone who is not an artist and not a genius, and I will include myself in that category, art is definitely essential to the grasping the ideal man. I could not reach the ideal man being neither an artist nor a genius by induction from observation. I couldn't, speaking for myself, because it would be too great, too much of a feat of abstraction, at least for me to be able to do. I did reach it by induction from artworks. So in this sense, you're absolutely correct. I would, for instance, to reach a view of John Galt, you have to grasp what is common to all his distinctive actions and then generalize all of these are such and such, that's essential to his character. All of these indicate that virtue, and then all of these virtues indicate such and such. So you have to induce from the hero's actions and from the multiple heroes in the different novels. And this is the substitute data, which finally leads you to the generalization, the ideal man is so-and-so. So in that sense, for most of us, I think the answer is yes. Without art, we would just be stopped cold on these questions. But that is not applicable to Ayn Rand or the Founding Fathers or the creators of the ideal, because they couldn't rely on previous creations. There is never a complete lack of data. Ayn Rand did not create her material ex nihilo. She herself said that she rearranged the data of reality. So she sees some acts of independence and of dependence in the great majority of men. She focuses on independence. She isolates it. She focuses on dependence, she isolates it, and then she creates characters in which they are presented pure. Rourke versus Keating. So, she is using actual data out there to generalize and reach the conclusion of what the ideal is in order to be able to project the data from which we then much more easily can reach the conclusion, because she's done the really hard induction from the raw, mixed-up data. And the same is true of the Founding Fathers. They did not create the ideal society ex nihilo. They studied all the preceding societies, and they had to abstract what were the good points and the bad points and rearrange and combine, you know, with new ideas and try to project what it would consist of. But once we have the United States, it's a hell of a lot easier for us to induce the necessity of freedom and rights than it was for them. So you see why it's yes and no. If there were truly no data, then the creator couldn't work either. There's no substitute for the ultimate datum, which is reality, including men as they are, however they are. Well, that's an interesting question. Now, this is from Nelson from... You got me. I never know. These emails don't have addresses, but it's Nelson somebody else. Oh, Bremerton... No. I don't know. I can't find a point. Anyway, the question is, did I understand you to say that induction would not be a good means of showing others the validity of objectivism? Or is it just that you shouldn't use induction in a polemical situation? What is the best method of showing non-objectivists the validity and power of objectivism? This is a new person to objectivism. You slightly misunderstood what I said. Induction is a form of cognition. So it is the method of teaching anything to anybody who is reasonable and open to learning. And in that sense, if I wanted to teach that man is reason is man's means of survival, if I wanted to convince an honest person, it would be no good for me to rattle off a rationalist deduction. I would have to say, look, you know, and give them a mini version. of what I just did. But obviously, the thing about induction is most of it has to be done by the person himself. The finding of examples everywhere, the range of examples, the abstracting of their common denominators. You cannot do that for another person. And this gives a deeper meaning to Ayn Rand's point that you can't think for another. If rationalism were true, you could, because you could beat him over the head with a syllogism. But you cannot beat him over the head with an inductive argument. Plus, if he is dishonest, every induction will give him 1,000 room to say, well, you don't need screwdrivers to survive, because I knew someone that never had screwdrivers and they survived, etc. So you'll not get anywhere by that means. So induction is great for cognition and hopeless for polemics. If you want to argue against somebody, you may as well throw out induction, because induction presupposes intellectual honesty, which deduction doesn't. I mean, even Bertrand Russell can deduce. So it gives you an idea. Now, from Steve in Virginia. Good question here. Until the 17th century, I'm just giving the essence of the question. I'm not reading the whole thing. Until the 17th century, the best understanding of causality, this is apropos of last week's lecture, was along the lines of Aristotle's idea that causality was true for the most part. Aristotle, by the way, held that all laws, scientific laws, are formulated as what's true, always or for the most part. Because, you know, for the it's mostly sunny or hot in the dog days was his example, but not always. Sometimes it's cold. So he couldn't find universal laws. So he said causality took the form of always or for the most part. He says, doesn't this show that a great deal of abstract scientific knowledge is necessary fully to understand causality? And in general, what I comment on the need or lack of need for scientific knowledge to inductively understand objectivism. Well, let's take the case of Aristotle first. Aristotle's philosophy, as I showed last week, gives you everything you need to reach causality, and he reached it on that basis, entity, identity, etc. But Aristotle couldn't find universal laws, exceptionless laws. Now, there are two explanations why he didn't find universal laws. Obviously, partly, that's ignorance. You can't find laws with all kinds of conditions if you don't advance science to a certain point. And he was simply laying down the principles of what science would consist of, so you couldn't expect him to go out and discover the laws himself. But at the same time, he had a Platonic element in him that prevented him from knowing how to interpret the fact that he couldn't find universal laws. He had the form-matter dichotomy inherited from Plato, which said that accidents or non-causal events are inherent in the makeup of the universe. And therefore, to him, always or for the most part, fitted into his level of knowledge and his Platonism. Now, if he hadn't been a Platonist, what would he have said? He would have said, I know that every action is caused, but there's an awful lot of cases where I don't get the cause. Or I only know one factor, but there's other factors that I don't know because I can't formulate it as a universal rule. Then, he would have fully understood causality as a philosophic principle. And then the spiral would have set in. When you got all those scientific principles, you would say, aha, now I see that it's not always, or for the most part, it's really always, but there are conditions I didn't even dream of that are making it seem to be only partial. And then you would go back and say, aha, now I really see even more deeply what it means that an entity has to act a certain way, because there's all kinds of entities I didn't dream of and all kinds of factors influencing them and so on. And then each reciprocally works The more laws you see, the more you say, "Ah, boy, I really see causality now." And the more you see it, the more you're open to still find it, as against people like Heisenberg who give up because they can't find it anymore. So you don't need scientific knowledge to understand causality. But if you mean, Steve, quote, fully understand, and fully means a later stage in the spiral, then obviously you do. You can't fully understand until you know everything. So from that point of view, we still don't fully understand, because who knows what is going to happen with the subatomic, you know, gelucil at the core of whatever, that's going to say, well, it is causal, but it's like nothing you ever dreamed of under Newton or Einstein. Say, gee, causality is even more than I thought it was, so I didn't fully understand. Or teleology and biology. There's 1,000 different ways and forms of causality. So the answer is, now, take it more broadly. Your question, the need of scientific knowledge to inductively understand objectivism. It would be basically true on everything that you can fully understand it without science on one level. But the enhanced understanding requires you to integrate it with the knowledge in every field, including science. Now, I myself happen to think, to really scandalize everybody, that science actually was essential to the development of epistemology in this way. I think that if they had not discovered that mathematics was essential to physics in the early modern world, I doubt that Ayn Rand could ever have discovered that mathematics was essential to concept formation. Because the barrier, you know, up until the 17th century or so, or 16th, whatever it was, they thought mathematics was a completely self-contained subject that had nothing to do with anything else. And it was an act of super genius to realize that mathematics, that our understanding of reality is in the form of mathematical laws. And without that revolution, I don't think that Ayn Rand could have grasped that mathematics is also our tool of concept formation. So what would you say? Could you have reached objectivism without science? Well, she could have reached basically what Aristotle had, you know, but without as intrinsicist a cast to it. But here's a case, a good case, I think, that science is actually crucial to a, quote, full understanding, even on the depth, on the deepest philosophic level. So what you have to say is you obviously can and must get crucial essentials as your start without science to make science possible. And then the scientific knowledge often gives you a fuller understanding or a lead to a more technical understanding that you wouldn't get without the science. So I don't make that absolutely rigid distinction between science and philosophy that some people do. And that is all I want to say. And now, where was that town in Wisconsin? What is it? Colgate, Wisconsin. Are you there? Can you unmute yourself? Hello?
Yes, we're here. Thank you.
All right, do you have a question?
Well, we're trying.
You're trying?
Here we go. I'll give you what I've got.
Okay, let me hear it loudly, please.
Well, you can turn them up.
Can you hear me?
Plus.
Go ahead.
I was interested in the way you demonstrated or contrasted the lower animals with man at a reasonably civilized state.
Right.
And I wonder, Is it necessary for us to, when we're doing this, to go back to a little less, something that's not quite as clear in the way of a contrast?
You mean like the missing link between animals and man?
That would be a very fuzzy spot, I think.
No. If I understand your question, the exact reverse is true. When you are inducing, you want to take the sharpest contrast that you can. It would be bizarre, for instance, to take the smartest ape and the dumbest freshman and use the two of them side by side to try to abstract what is the difference between man and the animals. Now, there are borderline cases. There are undoubtedly apes smarter than students that I have had. But that does not obliterate the essential distinction between animals and men. Borderline case merely means an area where it's difficult to know how to classify because it shares some characteristics of one and some of the other. By definition of being borderline, it has to be set aside when you are thinking, when you are categorizing, when you are philosophizing. And then after you finish, you come back to this missing link and say, I want to know now, is it something that survives by reason, or it has the capacity to, you know, make certain primitive abstractions, but it doesn't really do anything? It's sort of like a game that it plays, but its actual survival is sensory. Or, conceivably, it enhances its survival a little bit by the type of cave that it can dig or the type of banana it can make an instrument to get to the banana, and then you adapt your conclusion accordingly. You say that for this missing link is neither man nor animal. So you'd have to decide to what extent does it have the faculty of reason, and to what extent does that enable it to produce a higher form of life? And there might be gradations, but it wouldn't invalidate your conclusion. All it would do is what John Stuart Mill called concomitant variations. It would show that if suppose you could arrange a degree of there were human beings, and then there was the missing link, and then there were animals, and human beings were able to have 10,000 values that they could achieve, and animals zero, only what was given to them, and this could do 10. So then you could say, because it has a certain abstract capacity beyond the animals, it can do a bit more. You don't have to be able to have an exact cutoff point. It's simply, if nature is a continuum there, so is the application of the principle. But you reach the principle by completely ignoring borderline cases, otherwise you throw yourself into the confusing before you know the clear. Does that answer you?
Yeah, that's great. Perfect, thanks.
Okay, now according to my time, we have exactly 9 seconds, even counting all of the bonus material. So I'll take this opportunity to say thank you very much, and I'll speak to you next week.